Sam, we were going to record in the drawing room, I think.
Quite literally. Or the withdrawing room, which is, of course, where the ladies withdrew.
Oh, yes. Well, let's withdraw then.
While the men continued with their cigars and port and body talk.
And did the women not get any body talk in the drawing room?
Well, mostly our ears were too fragile to hear such things, but I'm sure we had our own bitching sessions behind the back of the scenes.
I imagine the women were happy to withdraw.
I think we probably were. And we're about to head through the blue room, which was Granny's boudoir. And of course,
what do people do in boudoirs?
Well, the word boudoir comes from a French word to sulk. So basically, a boudoir was a woman's sulking room.
So we withdrew and we sulked. These are all great verbs.
We weren't really allowed to do much else. At that stage, women were a category of subhumans or subspecies, along with women, children, criminals, and the insane. We were not considered equal human beings.
It's dreadful, really, isn't it?
Took a long time for that to change.
Now, here we are. We're in the drawing room.
Oh, look at that light. Isn't that a beautiful day?
Yeah, no, there's a beautiful view from here. It's really lovely. And you can see the lake and everything. It's gorgeous. I think this is probably the nicest room in the whole place, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. I love it in here, particularly now in autumn. It's really nice with all the trees and everything.
Isn't it?
And the autumnal light. Where will we park ourselves?
Where would you like to sit, ma'am? With the view or the fire?
Oh, the view. Always the view.
Always the view.
So here we are in Castle Leslie in County Monaghan for another episode of our Heritage at the Heart podcast. We're lucky to be joined today by Sammy Leslie on a most beautiful autumn day. So we're here looking out over the lake, Glasslough Lake, and I'm delighted to be here. And thanks very much, Sammy, for agreeing to be part of this podcast.
Always happy to support heritage, as you know.
Absolutely. And Sammy, you're obviously the custodian of this whole estate and the historic buildings and everything, but you're also most recently a member of the Heritage Council Board. How are you finding the responsibilities of being in such a national prominent position for heritage?
It's fascinating. It was 12 years with the Irish Heritage Trust went from its set up, and then I did my 10 years. So I was actually really quite honoured to get onto the Heritage Council. It's probably one of the first from the whole sort of privately owned or privately managed or looked after sector, which is interesting in its own way, because we don't quite know how much heritage we really have and who looks after it. But I have to say, it's a wonderful board. We have an amazing chair and our CEO is just fabulous. And looking at, we're also working on strategy for the sort of longer term understanding and sharing and caring for heritage. So it's a very exciting time. It's very exciting to be part of it. And especially for somebody who went through 9 schools by 15 and has no formal education, to end up on the Heritage Council is a huge honour.
Oh, well, it is pretty amazing, actually, isn't it? When you think of all those schools, you must have gone to the sulking room or the boudoir quite a bit or something.
I think I did a lot of sulking in school.
You've more than made up for it since.
Yeah, but that whole thing around neurodiversity and how people learn differently was just not part of the conversation when we were children. I think we were still on...
There were the 3 R's, I think, at school, and that was it, really, wasn't there?
Yeah.
There's no sense of emotional intelligence or any of those other intelligences that which we were also, or creativity or any of those things,
no.
Which are so important, and I think very important in the heritage world, where you do need that holistic appreciation, don't you, of the aestheticness or the aesthetic value of places, the historic value, scientific value, even the technical understanding of somewhere like this building, for example. We were here recently with the heritage officers, and I think some of the technical things that you were explaining explaining to us around climate, for example, and the doors and the way that you had retrofitted the doors. I think it was pretty, we were pretty astounded by those simple things, but difficult things to get right.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you're always trying to make a building, first of all, watertight, because water is an amazing ability to get through. You know, it only needs a gap of one molecule and it can work its way into buildings. You're always trying to bring it up to standards from health and safety and all the legislation and the fire legislation, while still make it look like nothing ever happened. And trying to keep everything as original in its sort of feel and character. So it's a constant exploration and a constant learning curve, because there's so few of these big old estates left, especially one that's, you know, so close and part and parcel of an estate village. I mean, they are absolutely joined at the hip. There's not that many people you can go and ask to learn from. We quite often end up just having to work stuff out.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, Ireland's got half the population of Yorkshire. We forget how small an isle we really
are. That's a very good point, yeah. And for all of the historic buildings that we do have then. And it is very hard, isn't it, to figure out sometimes what's the best thing to do with a building. You know, and you need so many people, and you ask, maybe you might ask an architect, a conservation architect. You might ask a building surveyor. You may ask somebody who's expert in a particular material, a stonemason, and they may all come up with slightly different...
Absolutely. And then the fire officer comes up with a whole different set of criteria. So it's always trying to juggle. But I also think the whole thing around climate change is really getting quite terrifying. You know, I was at a talk on Heritage 2030, and the Erasmus Professor for Climate from Maynooth gave a very enlightening presentation. And yes, it's not just going to affect heritage. And, you know, things like the famine are etched in our history. It was a desperate and dark time in this country. But if we don't stop doing what we're doing, it's not just about climate change, it's about climate justice, and it's about the low-lying nations that are just going to get wiped out, and the nations where the famine is caused by drought and the mass starvation, mass loss of wildlife, mass loss of biodiversity. You know, it's absolutely terrifying. And my goddaughter is Somali, and they haven't had rain in Somalia for 4 years.
Crikey.
And in Ireland, we are one of the worst in our carbon footprint. But because everything looks verdant and lush and green, we tend not to think about it. So it's not just our heritage. Our footsteps, our footprint, our carbon use impacts so many other people.
Yeah, I can see you're really concerned about that. And it is a very, it seems to be a divisive subject when it shouldn't be a divisive subject, because we're talking about, obviously, the future of humanity. And we're all equal, as we were talking about earlier, just as we came in. Everyone's equal, and it's a huge challenge, isn't it? And at the moment, we're sitting here, and it's day 3 of COP27 at the moment. And people are out in Egypt, obviously. And I was reading a paper this morning, in fact, where they said that in 100 years' time, a lot of those outdoor archaeological sites in Egypt will no longer be there because of climate, because of the impacts of climate. And I mean, that's a huge cultural loss. So we're talking about the loss of cultural places, the sense that people feel rooted where they are somewhere, and the movement of huge amounts of people from all these small island states. And yet we're sitting here in Ireland thinking, really, sometimes that's not much got to do with us.
Exactly. And that's the really sad thing, because there's somebody else somewhere else, and they're out of sight and out of mind. They're still our fellow human beings.
And do you think being engaged with heritage helps us understand more about climate, in that we feel more attached to our place and that we maybe understand how it works more?
Absolutely. I think we're more attached to the land, and we're more attached to the buildings, and we watch the changes. We watch the land, we watch the changes in biodiversity. I think we're a lot more in tune. But I also think, my mother was a war baby, and I grew up in a household of never wasting. You know, my mum's highlight as a child was getting the jam jar. The last person to get the jam jar got their finger in and got it around the rim, because that's where the last bit of, you know, jam was. And, you know, it was just, you threw nothing out. Everything got reused. And old houses, everything has been recycled and upcycled and repurposed over, you know, over the centuries. That's what they did. I helped look after a property in Italy. It's 1,500 years old, and there's no rubbish dump. Archaeologists cannot find a rubbish dump because everything was reused. I think heritage also has a big role to play in all our traditional building skills, because again, they were the ones that helped to continue making old houses, whether it's a vernacular cottage or, you know, a bigger house. They were the skills needed to keep those buildings alive. And we have 200 and something thousand empty buildings in this country.
Yeah, and I think a lot of them probably are the older vernacular traditional buildings that there does appear to be a lack of understanding that those buildings can be reused at the moment. And I know there's a new strategy out from the department. I think it's Living Heritage or the Living Tradition or something like that is called. And certainly within that, there's one section of the government trying to push these buildings as being really good and valuable places to live in. But the building industry has lost the skills necessary to repurpose these as homes and to understand that they don't maybe have the same type of foundations that a modern house would have, or the same type of behaviour from the point of view of humidity and damp and, you know, warmth and things like that.
Yeah, and you can't stick plastic paints on an old building because it'll sweat. You know, they do behave differently. A lot of it is about understanding the old drainage systems and, you know, how they actually got the damp and the water away from a house. And quite often you find something quite simple has got forgotten about or blocked. You know, you get all of the issues around windows, and I don't know if anybody found a solution. You get the whole issue around, you know, if you want to have a house and want to do it up to rent, it has to be to a certain
BER rating,
which it can be really hard to obtain because of the way we measure historic buildings, and then you're not allowed to do so many things. I mean, so many people just, it's easier to let the buildings fall derelict, which is
wrong, it's
on every level.
It seems easier, but it's not easier in the long run, obviously.
No, and every building that we manage to repurpose or bring back into use, every ton of concrete is a ton of carbon. Mm,
exactly.
You know, there was no way around that. There's some lower carbon concretes, which are a lot more expensive and harder to get, but we still, every ton of concrete is a ton of carbon because the lime has to be burnt to create the concrete. So can we stop
using it,
and can we go back to looking after, you know, our older buildings and get those buildings back into use? In England, this wouldn't happen. You know, my cousin in England lives in a cow shed that's made out of timber and mud.
Yeah.
It's Tudor. You look at it and you go, it's stunning.
Yeah.
It's a tiny kind croft. It's a tiny little cow shed and a row of them with animals underneath, and the people slept on top. And people go and photograph it because, you know, it's so pretty and so quaint. But it's timber and mud.
And
it was cherished and, you know, lived in for...
Isn't that mad?
And I mean, centuries.
They say there's quite a concentration of mud houses in around Rockcurry, County Monaghan. And, you know, it's quite muddy soil around there. It's quite clay and cloy, you know, kind of material. But as well as that, they said that there was, because a lot of the trees were felled in Ireland, that then people actually couldn't use timber. So they used mud only for a lot of these buildings. So there's actually very little timber in them at all. And they still managed to stay up. And, you know, bits of gravel and maybe hair and things like that in it.
And as long as you keep a good outside shell as such of your, you know, your whitewash, your skim on the outside that doesn't let the water in. And this thing of, oh, we need to knock it, it hasn't any foundations, you're going, it stood for 300 years. Yeah. Why do you need foundations? What do you call foundations? You know, the building, there's so little understanding on how to read a building, how to look at an old building and understand how it was built and to what scale.
And the joy in the discovery of that. You know, there's nothing greater in life than finding out stuff. Sure,
exactly.
You know what I mean? Doesn't matter what it is, how something works, how something is built, how it's put together. And to look at an old building and try to find those things out is a joy. And it should be taught more in universities or institutes or wherever, that you learn how to look at a building and figure the hell out how it was constructed.
Well, we would call it unpicking a building. We slowly unpick the layers. So, you know, things like looking like the depth of the skirting board or the detail on the architraving or the detail on a newel post or the detail in a chimney will tell you an awful lot about the level of skills and care that the house was built with, because if they went to the point of doing that level of detail, then they built the rest of the house really well.
Yes.
You know, so actually there's a lot more to it. I mean, we've had so many discussions about, you know, in Monaghan, a lot of the early houses, the sort of late 1500s, 1600 houses, have just been demolished in the last number of years because people...
A lack of understanding, would you say?
Yeah,
I've
read some of the reports on, and they've just said, oh, the house was 1870s. My grandmother, great-grandmother, was born in 1842, said that house is particularly ancient.
Yeah.
You know, this particular house has no Irish name in its translation because it was that early. It only ever had its English name. The Irish name so far gone. So, you know, we know there were stonemasons brought over from England in the 1600s. We know they built all sorts of things around here. But do we try and trace them? You know, it's all part of our heritage.
Yeah. And the contribution that can make to our future, isn't that it? More so than anything else as well, because the whole idea about heritage being about the past, but being what's going to happen now and in the future, isn't it? We're curating what's going to happen. We're remembering and keeping what will be there in the future.
Yeah.
If we can keep it, with the impact of climate, obviously.
Well, that's the big thing. You mentioned about, you know, reading and understanding a building, and it's quite fortuitous. This week, we have 5 students from SPAB, the Society for Protection of Ancient Buildings in the UK, mm-hmm. that have come here with different disciplines specifically to draw.
Wow, to draw buildings.
To draw this building. They're scattered to them all over the place today. But they each have a particular area of conservation and heritage management they're interested in. And the remit is, and the theory is, the more you sit and look at something and draw it, the more you have to look at it. You have to look at all of the detail. And then that trains your eye to see things that wouldn't normally see.
Yeah.
You can't learn off a screen. You can't learn off a book. Just sitting there.
It's observation. That lovely skill of observation.
Which is so missing here. I don't know how and where we teach people to observe.
Probably in art college, maybe, to look at the human form or to do those kind of life drawings. But I agree with
Inherited.
You. I think we need a lot more of that, even like in the field for botany, for example. You know, a lot of botanists would, some of them, become watercolour artists because they've spent so long studying the tiniest little differences in plants that their observation skills become so refined that they then can, you know, draw them basically really, really well and accurately. But it is that, isn't it? We can't rely on Google.
No.
We have to stop relying on Google.
and it's a two-dimensional flat screen. Yeah. You know, there's 8 dimensions. You know, a cube's got 6 sides of it, and then there's below it and inside it.
Yes.
But... you know, for us growing up, we always talked about having an eye.
Yes.
And we were all taught to have an eye in different ways. Mine comes in very useful in car boot sales.
Yes.
And just finding bits of copper. Like, copper is one of my...
Maybe your animal bird is a magpie.
Maybe. And I bought some fabulous copper recently in Athenry. And he said, oh, it's made in the side of the road. And it was proper old,
beautiful,
handmade,
measured by the thumb.
And it was old boilers and pipes that had been cut up. And it was proper old tinker copper.
Lovely.
And when that was a trade that was a respected
trade.
Hugely respected. And we've lost, you know, there's 2 people left with those skills in the country.
And those are amazing skills. If you've ever seen the programme Hands, I think there's an episode where the tinsmith is measuring literally jugs with his thumb.
Yeah.
And he gets it exactly into a pint. He can just completely replicate it as a machine would each time. Like, amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The
and
skill in that.
The skills. They're almost gone. So I think we've a lot to do around teaching and understanding buildings and traditional skills. And that goes back to, that really helps with climate change because we stop throwing things away
because we appreciate them more.
We value things. That the throwaway society...
I hear you. I hear you. You're exasperated with it. I mean, the opportunities for somewhere like here to show that you can have objects for a long time and keep them, even though they're not in fashion anymore, or, you know, not part of the current, you know, je ne sais quoi style, but because they were made by hand at the time.
Absolutely.
And they last forever then if they're cared for.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know what we were using the other day. oh, the curtains in the dining room. It's like, yep, they're 140 years old.
Yeah.
They were just made with incredible heavyweight green felt.
Yeah.
And, you know, 140 years later, they're still there.
Well, that's a beautiful use of a textile.
And they've never faded. Yeah.
Hear about those green felt curtains, but we're here at the moment in the drawing room, and this is a beautiful room. How would you describe this room now, if to our listeners?
Well, I think you go back to the beauty of the landscape here that was created by the ice age. Created, it's amazing to think 10,000 years ago we'd be sitting under a quarter of a mile of ice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how quickly climate can massively change. We've ended up with a stunningly beautiful sculpted landscape. The lake and the vista, you know, out over the woods is one of, I think, one of the prettiest in Ireland. And when the house was rebuilt, it was designed to have these huge picture windows and capture as much of the view as possible. And what's really interesting about this room, it was designed not to have any curtains.
Yes.
The shutters all have an amazing mechanism that when you close them all out, it just is like their whole area is panelled.
Beautiful.
And it stops. So we have tried curtains a couple of times. They really didn't work. But this room is about trying to keep it as much as close to it as it's always been. So the carpet in here, the original carpet was Persian, probably about 280, 300 years old. And it's just literally... funny enough, after all that time, was starting to wear out. So through the late John Coote, we got it remade. It took 18 months to knot, and they absolutely reproduced it. And this carpet will probably do another 100, 150 years, 200 years, depending on, you know, the amount of time. So everything's just been sort of very gently done in a way to keep it as close as it always was. I mean, the fireplace alone, you know, that salvage, that came out of a church in Florence. It's by Andrea Luca della Robbia, made in the 1490s, you know, so it's just kept being recycled.
It's a lovely, it's beautiful. I mean, what I'm looking at here is that there's lots of paintings of different sizes, and some with gilded frames and gilded mirrors at the end of the room. And then the picture windows on two sides of the room, which look down two different views of the lake and the trees. And then it's a very gentle colour of, I would call this room a rusty, chestnutty colour, I think, along with the panellings. I'm just trying to give an impression for people who aren't here. And then there's a beautiful ceiling. What kind of a plaster ceiling is that? It's gorgeous. It's got a beveled edge
and the little oak leaves.
Yeah, are they little oak? Oh, yeah, they are.
Oak leaves and...
oh, yeah.
I don't know what the other one is, and you've asked me a question I can't quite answer. But the ceilings are stunning. But all the colours in this room are those wonderful soft gilts and golds. Mm. They're all the autumnal colours. So as the light and the wind autumn start to close in, and you start to close the shutters and light the fire,
cozy.
It becomes really a warm, soft glow in the room. Everything is designed to glow, and everything, including how jewellery was cut, and that's how they call old and glass was cut, was designed to sparkle in candlelight.
Oh, how romantic.
And then, I know, and we all looked more beautiful by candlelight.
Yeah.
And then as things changed and we went to modern light, the glass cutting and, you know, the pitch framing, everything changed to look better in top ceiling lights, which are much whiter. So this room is designed to be enjoyed, you know, low level light and firelight and candlelight.
Oh,
and that's why we try to keep it at that sort of soft levels.
It's beautiful. And then when you look out, obviously here we are looking out at the landscape that you say is so beautifully sculpted through the ice age. And then, of course, so we're looking at the lake, and there's a wetland in the distance that we can't really see, but there's quite a lot of native woodland around the fringes of the lake. And I know you're hoping to do a rewilding project or in the estate, aren't you?
Absolutely.
So that's really interesting.
Well, it's not just us. It's four estates, two old estates, ourselves and Burr, and two estates with new custodians, which is Kalua and Lagaloa.
Okay.
All of the estates have different types of landscape. different types of biodiversity. In Birr, they found calcified lamprey.
Oh, my goodness.
I didn't think lamprey still existed here.
They do.
They do.
Yeah, yeah. Park lamprey and river lamprey, and there's another one.
Well, they were one of Henry VIII's favourite foods. Lamprey pie was
really?
A great delicacy. They almost got eaten to extinction.
They are a protected species, so we won't be putting them in a pie.
No, but for our listeners, I know this is radio. If you Google one thing, Google a lamprey, L-A-M-P-R-A-Y,
E-Y,
on images. Just don't blow the screen up too big. They have to be one of nature's least friendly looking creatures.
Oh, they're very unattractive. They are. They've got very large mouth parts that they use to sort of attach themselves onto things. Yeah, they're
they
very
like
old species. They're very, you know, ancient species.
They look prehistoric, and they look like they came out of Alien.
Yeah.
We're supposed to make great pie, which is why we managed to. I mean, I think that's also that you start to look at the statistics of the number of species in Ireland and the UK that we've wiped out. We tend to think species extinction is about Africa and the Big Four and, you know, the things we see on David Attenborough's wildlife programmes. In Ireland, we have wiped out the Irish pig.
Yes.
Genetically, it's gone. There is no Irish pig left. The humble muck was such a central part to so many small holdings.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Somewhere, somebody, we just went, nah, that animal's not any use to us, and it's gone.
Well, it was part and parcel of the woodlands, wasn't it? You know, the Irish boar. So it was. Its habitat were woodlands. So I suppose when the woodlands were pushed west, the boar got pushed west.
But also the farmyard pig.
And the farmyard pig as well.
Farmyard pig's gone.
Yeah.
You know, because we were looking at part of the rewilding, we do one of our baseline studies, so we can measure the impact on biodiversity, water, carbon, soil quality and biodiversity. And one of the things is in introducing pigs, ponies, deer, that because it's how they move around the ground.
Yeah.
It's how they eat seeds and pee and poo them out other places. That's how they tread the ground and break the top of the sward so other seeds can get in. You know, they're very much part of it. And we couldn't find any Irish pigs. That was a moment when I went, oh my God, we just wipe out things.
We wipe them out, we don't think twice about it, you know?
No.
And I know that Ella McSweeney, you know, she's the wildlife presenter, she recently was looking at moths down in Killarney, and she was explaining how many moth species there are in Ireland. So I think there's 1,600 moth species. So those are night flying butterflies, essentially. But then for the day flying butterflies, there's only something like 34. So obviously we're missing a bunch, because there's no way there would have been such a disparity in numbers of species.
Wow.
It's quite amazing, isn't it? So, but the Irish pig, I know it would be, there's a lot of people here who like a bit of pork, but the Irish pig and all of those other species, they are very fundamental to this, to the rewilding idea, aren't they?
Yeah.
This herbivore-led rewilding. That's essentially what it is, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, and pigs are nature's ploughs.
Mm.
They're brilliant at turning the soil up and breaking it up so other things can get in. And then it'll be a balance between where we let the rewilding happen, where we can do nature-based farming for nature, so
yeah,
we still need to produce food. But a lot of the research in the UK would show that if you have 100 acres, it's a nice easy figure for it to divide, you take 20 to rewild, the productivity of the 80 acres becomes the same as the 100 because the soil quality improves because of the biodiversity,
yeah,
etc.
You've got microbes, you've got things eating pests, your whole food chain is improved.
Absolutely.
Immediately.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, this whole argument about rewilding, you know, taking land out of food production, you're going, no, actually, if it's done right, it actually can help. And then we've lots of interesting debates around formal gardens. It's how do you get, you know, that how do you lighten the carbon footprint? How do we get off as many, you know, additives as we can? So at the moment we have got Bill and Ben, and they are somewhere around the garden, and every now and again they pop up and terrify you, like, ah, what are you? What? And they are large electric robots. So our lawn, they're called the lawn bots. And in the old days you had lawn boots, which horses wore, and the lawn boots, the horse would walk around mowing the lawn, pulling a lawnmower, and they had big leather boots on to stop him marking the grass.
I didn't know that.
And this is
That's
where, and I can't find, I have a set of lawn boots and I can't find them. So I want to do a photograph of our lawn boots
beside your lawn box.
And they are amazing, but no, they run on electricity, so there's no fuel. They're a lot more labour efficient, so it means people can get on with more interesting things than sitting on a lawnmower. And they mulch the grass back in. And they're very clever. If they need charging, they'll go off and find their charger. And if you try and pick them up and take them out of their area, they'll scream blue murder at you.
That's a brilliant innovation. So you mean you're right, like for somewhere like here, the historic nature of it means you have a lot of things to balance. So you have your historic building assets, your, you know, all your massive estate walls, of course, as well. They're a huge issue, I suppose, imagine. So then a walled garden, which is a different type of planting regime in the past, whether or not you carry that forward, and then your whole rewilding and your farm. There's a lot of decisions.
A lot of different parts. And then we're looking at, you know, because people forget estates were very innovative.
Yeah.
Good estates were very innovative. A lot of the states didn't give a toss. So places like Birr, their innovation was around science, gardens,
amazing.
And astronomy.
The stars.
Astronomy, absolutely. And engineering. I mean, they had vortex technology for hydro and electricity in the 1870s.
Wow.
And here was very innovative around farming and land management, about best breeding stocks, about farm schools, about furniture making, and also about hydrology. So they built the first pumped water, we understand the first pumped water system in Ireland for an estate and a village. So instead of pumping water up, you turned a tap on in the village and the water came out, which was huge. They did some of the first flush outside toilets in a village. So we're having a look at all the old hydrology and go, well, is there something within that we can then adapt then to
I suppose already you did kind of adapt some of that when you're thinking about, I'm trying to think about the trajectory on the toilet line here, so I'm thinking about your constructed wetlands that you do have in the estate that serve Glasslough Village as well, don't they? So those kind of partnerships are very important, aren't they?
Absolutely. And that's, you know, and we've always, the estate always then went on and did all of the water, did the sewage, built the schools, you know, and did a lot of the functions that then got handed over to the county councils. You know, as time progressed, the integrated wetlands, because we always had the sewage works on the estate, ended up, we all call it the poo farm. It's nature's answer to nature's problem. Nature always has had a way to break down waste.
Of course, or otherwise the landscape would be littered with waste of all types, of human detritus everywhere.
We'd be up to our necks in dinosaur bits.
We would. Yeah, only for the, I mean, I think we have to say something here about fungi and
the little guys,
the fungi. And just to say that I was fungi foraging at one stage in your woodland with the National Biodiversity Data Centre years ago, and the fungi that were down in that woodland were amazing. Like these big lumps of chicken in the woods attached to some of the trees, the big orange fungi, which apparently are very tasty to eat. But you know, all of that, those whole microbes, I think it really emphasises the importance of having large areas of landscape that are relatively away from human impact. Or too much human impact. I mean, you can't prevent it. It's in the air. We've managed to infiltrate everything, haven't we, at this stage? But really, just even to hold on to species, because obviously those microbes or the mycorrhizals and things that are in the soil, they won't keep. They just can't carry on indefinitely if they don't have the habitat there.
Yeah. And you look at, you know, the stats around healthy soil and how much soil we have and how many growing years we've got left. You know, we really do need to start to rethink. But Ireland's in an incredibly good position to be able to do that. I think we just need more collaborative thinking and, you know, less, as somebody said, less reports.
And I wanted to get right into your brain. So if you were in charge, what three things would you do for climate? No.
Minister Humphreys put it beautifully in saying that, you know, the fuel crisis should be to climate change what COVID was to home working. Now, on every single touch point, we need to make changes. What three things would I change? I would make it so much easier for people to retrofit old houses and get all the houses that we have lived in and used. I would support communities to come off the grid as much as possible. You know, we did a sustainable energy community for this area, but it's a long and hard process, and it's not easy to actually put anything into action.
It's not user-friendly at all.
It's not user-friendly, you know, and departments and bodies don't talk to each other. It's back to, we have half the population of Yorkshire, can we just all get in a room and sort this out, please?
Yeah.
You know, the can we stop moving tight chairs on the Titanic? Can we just figure out how we avoid that iceberg? Because, you know, we're going to hit it pretty hard. And there's an app in the US, which is brilliant, that you can put all your household information into. It's linked to all the utility suppliers.
Okay.
And it's also, as you retrofit something, it helps you understand the cost benefit and also the carbon impact. So it gives individuals the tools that they need to try and make the right decisions, because it is so confusing out there.
Yeah.
It is so confusing. Whereas if you empower the individual to be able to make small changes and measure the changes and see the successes and the failures of trying to do different things, because every household is different, every family is different, there's no one fit, for one solution fits all. It's just about empowering people on the ground in a very simple, user-friendly way, and encouraging everybody to make a difference. Simple things. Don't fill your kettle to the very top if you only want one cup of tea.
Yeah, that's a very true thing. There are a lot of simple things that we can do collectively that will make a difference.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I heard Mary Robinson this morning, and she was saying that Antonio Guterres needed to be making these harsh statements, these shocking statements, to make governments listen. But that for the individual and for people on the ground, we needed hope. We needed to be able to feel that we actually still can do something, even if, you know, we feel that we're a small country. But it doesn't matter. We still have more emissions than, I think, 400 million of the poorest 400 million people in the world. Yeah. Ireland as a country. Ireland. So, you know, where's the equality in that?
Ireland Inc., 12 tons of carbon on average per man, woman and child in this country.
I know we should be ashamed, really, you know. So hopefully we can, but I want to end on that, on the positive note that we had before that, and to thank you very much, Sammy, for participating in our podcast today and for your words of wisdom. I think the listeners will really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Well, Shirley, thank you for all that you do in your role as Heritage Officer in trying to make, protect this very special corner of the country. I mean, I am totally biased about North Monaghan, but you can see why when you look out the window. But
oh, no, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
The Heritage at the Heart podcast series is supported by the Heritage Council and Monaghan County Council.